Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is January the 29th, 2020. A shout out to the military men and women serving our country. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it is on at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the news, nearly all ThinkPads have defective USB-C ports. Relief from hidden cable TV fees. Pluto TV is a must-have free streaming service for cord cutters. Microsoft issuing free Windows 7 fix after introducing bug and final updates. And, in the news, Apple Macs can't get viruses or malware. Is that a fact or a myth? Our feature segments this evening is from Benjamin Rockwell on his IT Pro series, Passwords Are a Necessary Evil. From the Tech Corner, I'll be talking about what is the Internet of Things and how does it work? And the FCC gives Google and Sony permission to dole out the 3.5 gigahertz spectrum, which is part of 5G. And All Hands on Tech by Marty Winston and his presentation on small-scale solar power for outdoor devices. But first, the tech news of the week. Nearly all ThinkPads have defective USB-C ports. What to do now? Lenovo's ThinkPads regularly ranks at the top of the best business laptops list, but a serious issue with newer models threatens to damage their strong reputation. ThinkPad laptops from 2017 to 2019 reportedly contain defective USB-C ports. First reported by Notebook Check, the problems are widespread enough for Lenovo to post a support page titled Critical Intel Thunderbolt Software and Firmware Updates. Based on that document, the USB-C ports in more than a dozen ThinkPad laptops are experiencing serious issues. Lenovo posted a list of symptoms customers could encounter if they own a defective device. USB-C port doesn't work. Intel Thunderbolt controller not visible in the OS device manager. USB-C or Thunderbolt docking stations not visible or having connectivity problems. HDMI output not available. System battery not charging with a USB-C power adapter connected to the USB-C port. Intel Thunderbolt pop-up error messages. Intel Thunderbolt safe mode error messages. And BIOS Thunderbolt communicate or hang during post. Which ThinkPad models are affected? Dozens of ThinkPad models are affected by USB-C failures, including some of our favorite devices. Among those are the ThinkPad X1 Carbon, 5th generation to 7th generation, the X1 Yoga, 2nd generation to 4th generation, and P-Series ThinkPads. Lenovo posted a full list of affected laptops, and it's not pretty. The list is extensive. So if you have a problem, go to the Lenovo site to check if your particular ThinkPad model is one of those affected. What to do if you own a ThinkPad? If you own a ThinkPad laptop, go to the Lenovo support page, scroll to the bottom, and download the appropriate drivers. These driver and firmware packages are designed to fix any USB-C problems. If they don't, Lenovo urges you to reach out to Lenovo technical support. Lenovo is adding more drivers for more laptops if yours isn't currently listed. Relief from hidden cable TV fees. Look closely at your cable bill. You might be surprised to find fees you never heard of. Driving up the cost. Broadcast TV fee. Regional sports fee. Set-top box or rental fees. And many more. Add it all up, and according to Consumers Reports, the average cable subscriber pays nearly $450 in customer-imposed fees every year. So, how can you cut those pesky fees? If you guess cutting the cable TV cord, you're right. A good quality digital antenna costs around $35 and can tune in local TV stations for free. Streaming services on your smart TV or streaming device might charge a monthly subscription fee, but that's it. Congress passed a law last December that does three basic things. Number one, it requires cable companies to disclose at the point of sale, meaning right when you're going to sign up for services, of what your total overall price is going to be, including all fees and taxes. Number two, if you don't like it, you have 24 hours to change your mind and cancel without penalty if you want to get out of that deal. And number three, you no longer will have to pay for equipment that the cable company gives you, like a Wi-Fi router, even if you don't use that router. You no longer have to pay for it. The third point is important because for many people who have already signed up for a subscription service, they already know how much more they're paying for the extra fees, and they're locked into a 1 or 2 or more years of service. But you may find that you are paying for equipment that you're not using, such as remotes, routers, and so on. I'm using my own equipment. You're charging me for equipment that I'm not using. You can get that bill cut. Pluto TV is a must-have free streaming service for cord cutters. If you became a cord cutter with the goal of saving money, free streaming services can be a great way to get more content without racking up more monthly subscription charges. With options like Pluto TV, you can watch hundreds of curated channels all for free. What is Pluto TV? Pluto TV is a free streaming TV service with over 100 channels. With the Pluto app, you will get news, sports, movies, TV shows, viral videos, cartoons, and more. Pluto TV has both live and on-demand content. How much does it cost? Well, here's the good news. Pluto TV is absolutely free. If you don't mind 30-second ad breaks, you can get all the content on Pluto TV for $0. You can watch Pluto TV on the following devices: Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Chromecast, Apple TV, Android TV, Vizio Smart TV, Samsung Smart TV, Sony Smart TV, Windows, Mac, iO devices, and Android devices. What channels are available? Pluto TV has a unique mix of channels featuring a wide variety of content from sources all over the internet. You'll find well-known sitcoms, stand-up comedy, obscure horror movies, music, videos, and much more. On the grid guide, channels are grouped based on genres. Browse channels in categories including movies, entertainment, news, binge watch, comedy sports, explore, life plus style, tech plus geek, kids, Latino, and music. Pluto TV is also known for their dedicated channels. These channels would change based on season, major events, upcoming holidays, all which content the Viacom-owned service is promoting at any given time. For example, right now, you'll find a channel dedicated to Degrassi, another showing episodes of The Addams Family 24/7, and another with election coverage. Can the channels be customized? Yes. While you don't need an account to watch Pluto TV, you can choose to sign up for free on the website to personalize your channel lineup. When you log in, you can favorite channels that you like to navigate to easily and high channels that you don't want to see in your lineup? Can you record the content? Well, Pluto TV does not currently have a cloud DVR option. Can you watch more than one screen at once? Yes. Pluto TV does not require a subscription or a login, so you can watch on as many screens as you want. Do you know that they have a free app for iOS, Android, and Amazon Fire? Check it out, Pluto TV. Microsoft is issuing free Windows 7 fix after introducing a bug in that final update that they had sent out. This update was originally offered to paying customers only. However, it's been almost 2 weeks since Microsoft officially ended its extended support for Windows 7. But the Redmond firm is introducing another free update for the OS that fixes a bug it introduced in the final public updates. You know what that bug was? It was causing wallpaper problems for users, and in many cases, an image can display as black when set to stretch. Many people thought that was a deliberate thing to try to get people off of Windows 7. Well, it wasn't. It was a bug. As reported, one of Microsoft's final free Windows 7 update is causing wallpaper problems for some users. After installation, an image can display as black when set to stretch. The issue only appears to affect stretch wallpaper. Fit, fill, tile, or center options still work normally. Microsoft had initially said that the fix would be available to organizations who pay the expensive Extended Security Update, that's the ESU, but it has now decided to offer it for free for everyone running Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 Release 2 Service Pack 1. While the bug isn't exactly a major one, the fact that Microsoft introduced it just as the company stopped supporting non-paying Windows 7 users is a bad look. Pushing out the fix to everyone will help avoid some negative PR. The ESU, Extended Service Updates, aren't cheap. During the first year, those using Windows 7 Enterprise will pay $25 per machine. This doubles to $50 in the second year, and it goes up to $100 for the third year. And for those using Windows 7 Pro, it starts at $50 before going up to $100 in year 2 and $200 in the final year 3. Consider this 3-year period as filing for an extension on your income tax return. You are still running on Windows 7, but you would like some extended time to get off. Well, you effectively are paying for a 3-year window to get yourself off of Windows 7. Many businesses have been slow to migrate from Windows 7 to Windows 10, including the German government, which has to pay Microsoft $886,000 for the extended service updates. In other Windows 7 news, the Free Software Foundation is demanding. Of course, they can demand, but that doesn't mean that Microsoft will comply with it, that the operating system itself be released as free open software. With the expiration of update support for Windows 7, much has been written as to which version of Linux might be the appropriate replacement operating system. This is totally a misdirection. There is an estimated 29% of the installed base of Windows operating system that is Windows 7. The issue is what operating system is compliant with the applications installed on the system with Windows 7. We buy a computer in support of an application that meets our processing requirement. We don't buy a system and then ask what applications will run on it. Additionally, on a separate point, it has been said that Windows 10 will be the last Microsoft Windows operating system. That does not mean it will disappear. In effect, Microsoft is supporting Windows 10 with rolling updates twice a year. That means the equipment requirements will increment with each new update. As I had previously noted, the Dell laptop I purchased in November of 2016, configured with 32 GB of storage and 4 GB of memory, struggles with the latest Microsoft Windows 10 build number 1903. If you plan to upgrade the existing system, plan for a minimum of 8 GB RAM and 128 GB of storage. You may find that if a hardware upgrade is needed, it may not be cost-effective after the initial upgrade. Apple Macs can't get viruses or malware. Is that fact or myth? There's a common misconception that If you're using a Macintosh, your computer can't get viruses. This myth has been spread far and wide through mass disinformation, but it first started through an old advertising campaign back in 2006. There is now the sneaky, simple malware that hits millions of Macs. It's called the Slaver Trojan. Slaver, not the most sophisticated malware on the block, but its distribution network makes it surprisingly common on Macs. The popular misconception that Macs don't get viruses has become a lot less popular in recent years, as Apple devices have weathered their fair share of bugs. But it's still surprising that the most prolific malware on macOS, by one count, affecting 1 in 10 devices, and it is so relatively crude. This past week, antivirus company Kaspersky detailed the 10 most common threats in macOS users encountered in 2019. At the top of the list, the Slayer Trojan, which hit 10% of all the Mac's Kaspersky monitors and accounted for nearly a third of detections overall. It's led the pack since it first arrived in February of 2018. You think that such prevalence could only be achieved by a comparable sophistication. That wasn't the case. From a technical viewpoint, Slayer is a rather ordinary piece of malware. Kaspersky wrote in its analysis, in fact, it relies on some of the oldest tricks in the books. Convincing people to click on a bad link, then pushing a fake Adobe Flash update. Even the Trojan's payload turns out to be a garden variety adware. Slayer's brilliance, it turns out, lies less in its code than its method of distribution. The operators behind the Trojan reportedly offer website owners, YouTubers, and Wikipedia's editors a cut if they push visitors toward a malicious download. A complicit domain might prompt a phony flash download. While a shortened or mass link in a YouTube video description or Wikipedia footnote might initiate the same. Kaspersky says it accounted more than 1,000 partner sites distributing Slayer. One individual, Kaspersky says, currently owns 700 domains that redirect Slayer download landing pages. The head of advanced threat research and software classification at Kaspersky said, distribution is a vital part of any malware campaign, and Slayer shows that affiliate networks are pretty effective in this sense. While Slayer is simple, the adware it installs, a wide variety, since Slayer itself is just a delivery mechanism, can deploy at least a modestly clever trick or two. In an instance of the Simply adware that Kaspersky observed, the malware first poses as another program. In this case, any search. In the background, Simply attempts to install a malicious Safari extension and generates a fake installation complete notification window to cover up the macOS security notification that warns you against doing so. It tricks you, in other words, into granting permission to let it run amok on your device. Once you do, the attacker can both intercept your search queries and seed the results with their own ads. It's an annoyance more than anything, but given that over 100 million people use macOS and it hits at least 10% of those with Kaspersky installed, it's reasonable to assume that millions of Mac users deal with it every year. It's not clear how many it actually infects. A thunderstorm drops rain on lots of houses, but only a handful leak. But even if only a small percentage of those attempts prove successful, it's apparently enough to keep the operation going. Apple's done a great job making the OS more and more secure with each new release, says Kaspersky, but it is hard to prevent such attacks on the OS level since it's the user who clicks on the link and downloads Slayer and runs it like any other software. While Flash might seem like an outdated lure, given the numerous public warnings about its fallibility and the fact that it's dying off completely this year anyway, it's actually perversely effective. I think the reason why fake Flash plays are so successful in spite of these facts is twofold, says the chief security analyst at Intego, which first discovered Slayer nearly 2 years ago. Force of habit, and lack of awareness of the current state of Flash. To the first point, people have been so accustomed to serious Flash vulnerabilities that they're conditioned to update ASAP to avoid calamity. And as for the second, the average consumer has no idea that Flash is really used by modern sites, that Flash installers are no longer necessary, or that Flash is being terminated this year. Of course, with the long-term false narrative that Macs don't have malware or viruses, this lowers the user's alertness, none of which means Mac owners are especially susceptible. The techniques used to deceive users to install Slayer also works fine with users of any other platform and OS. The best way to protect yourself from Slayer and other malware are similarly universal. Don't click suspicious links, especially not surprise pop-up windows, and don't install Flash in the year of our Lord 2020, especially not from a site that promises, well, a pirated live stream. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell, Passwords Are Necessary Evil.
This is Benjamin Rockwell. It's time to get back to work. Okay, maybe I'm taking that a little bit too far. But it is time for us to discuss, yes, computer technology in the workplace and how it relates to us. I come to this bringing 30 years of experience as an IT professional, current and past experience, and hopefully you'll learn something out of this. As I'm sitting here right now, I'm talking to you. My password needs to be reset at the office. And I just got the notice yesterday. It's perfectly fine. And I'm going to tackle that and I'm going to address it because I have to. But I'll tell you right now that I understand the value of passwords. I understand just how important they are. We've had computer passwords around for a very long time. A gentleman died last year by the name of Fernando Corbato. And Fernando is credited for the first use of passwords to secure access to files on what was then a large computer system. We're talking back in the early 60s. But things have changed a lot since then, but they've still remained the same. We should still be utilizing and welcoming passwords. Why do I say that? Anyway, we should be utilizing passwords everywhere. But I still, to this day, see people all the time. I don't bother with passwording this. I don't bother with passwording that. Or, you know, we did that for the longest time with our cell phones. So many people just had no passwords for their cell phones. That just meant that anybody could walk up, pick up your cell phone. They grab it. They take it on home. They've got access to all of your information, all of your photos, all of your email. And today, actually, it's worse because we've got things like Google Pay, and we've got Apple Pay, and we've got our Apple Wallet. So we have all of these different ways for people to use our money. But even beyond that, even moving to the next level, we need to recognize that passwords should be utilized on all of our technology. So yes, we stick with the basics of we need to have numbers, letters, and special characters. When we talk about letters, uppercase, lowercase, yeah, we should be putting all of this into all of our passwords. I'm not going to get into the whole, yes, you need to do this with your password or that. That's another story for another day and all that. But for right now, let's talk about the idea of just the basic of you should have a password on every bit of technology. Most people, I was just in a conversation with a very well-known IT guy, and he was saying, yeah, I don't bother passwording my home computer. I said to him, you're kidding me, right? What would happen if somebody stole your home computer? Well, I hadn't thought about it like that. You hadn't thought about the idea of somebody breaking into your house and stealing your home computer? I mean, this happens all the time. This is something that happens very frequently. And what kind of data is on your home computer? And I'll tell you, on my home computer, I have a number of different things there. First, I do have passwords in my system. I do keep a log of a lot of passwords that are there that I really wouldn't want anybody getting. It's obscure passwords for obscure systems that I use once a year. Oh, I've got to sit here. I got to remember, what is the password that I use for that particular website? You know, and I have to sit there and I have to recover those too. So I don't want to deal with that. I have access to all of my banking on there. If somebody has my computer, they will find out who I bank with within a matter of minutes. This is something that you cannot hide. Even if you go through and you are utilizing something like the anonymous web surfing options in every browser. Yeah, great. You know, that's still going to have cookies left behind. There's still going to be remnants, little bits and pieces that will be left behind. No matter what anybody says, they're going to be able to track down who you bank with. Well, most people, when they enter in a password, okay, so I go to my bank right now. If I go to my bank website, it remembers my password from the last time that I logged into my bank account. That means that anybody who gets on my system can actually move money from my bank account to their own. Now, okay, you're saying nobody would ever steal your home computer. Now, actually, that is one of the biggest targets these days. And they're not targeting it for the cash that they used to be able to get out of it. They're targeting it for your documentation, your individual information about who you are. And that's unfortunate. And we have this not only on that level, but we also have this on the hacker level where they're trying to access your system via remote, where they're installing different software packages on your system via Trojans or viruses or worms or any other of a number of different things. And they're trying to get information that way. And your passwording, your system, and all of your items is important. Just as we use a PIN code to utilize our ATM card, we should be using whatever password, whatever strong password that we can to ensure that nobody accesses any of our information, any of our emails, any of our banking information, any of our web surfing, any of our personal plans for retirement. You name it, there's a reason why somebody's going to be after it. Please consider a password for your systems. Consider making stronger passwords. Ask your bank if they have an option for a 6-digit, an 8-digit PIN code instead of the crazy 4 digits that we've been remaining with for a long time. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is the Internet of Things, and how does it work? The Internet of Things is the concept of connecting any device, so long as it has an on-off switch, to the Internet and to other connected devices. The Internet of Things, otherwise in shorthand noted as IoT, is a giant network of connected things and people, all of which collect and share data about the way they are used and about the environment around them. In early December 2013, in a conference held in London sponsored by ThingMonk, the Internet of Things was organized. The conference brought together 20 speakers along with several leading players in the IoT space, sharing their vision on hardware, sensor, data, integration, and user experience for the Internet of Things. What does it mean for the ordinary man in the street? The shift to making everything mobile, connected, and internet-enabled has already begun. This shift is also compelling companies to undergo a radical transformation. McKinsey Global Institute tells us in what is called the Internet of Things, sensors and actuators embedded in physical objects, from roadways to pacemakers, are linked through wired and wireless networks, often using the same internet protocol that connects the internet. These networks churn out huge volumes of data that flow to computers for analysis. To make sense of that statement, it is perhaps important to list the 6 main attributes that make up the things in the Internet of Things. Connectivity, sensors, quality and reliability, energy efficiency, cost effectiveness, and security. The six attributes in the Internet of Things are moving parts. There are multiple standards across different nations. They are not necessarily in sync with each other, nor should we expect this to happen at any time. Manufacturers are moving forward and not wait for everyone to agree on some international global set of standards. The Internet of Things incorporate a new landscape where everyday objects like appliances or buildings, animal or people are provided with unique identifiers and the ability to automatically transfer data over a network without requiring human-to-human or human-to-computer interaction. Market intelligence provider International Data Corporation has declared the Internet of Things will change everything and be a new construct in the information and communications technology world. To put that in plain English, the Internet of Things and soon the Internet of Everything is going to be the next large-scale market transition. That means for the vast majority of devices or things not currently connected, they will soon be rather than later, and the network is going to be instrumental in that process. 5G, or fifth generation cellular communication technology, has become a hot topic across industries for its potential impact on emerging technologies, and specifically the Internet of Things, which describes the development, manufacture, and use of connected devices. These devices range from small heart rate monitors, autonomous vehicles, smart home appliances, intelligent factories, and much more. Together, such tools share the use of sensors, chips, and processors to collect, transfer, and analyze data, all the while interacting with other devices on the network. While the number of connected devices worldwide has already begun to proliferate rapidly, the launch of 5G networks is expected to significantly accelerate consumer and enterprise adoption of IoT products and services. 5G is a set of emerging global telecommunication standards, generally using high-frequency spectrum to offer network connectivity with reduced latency and greater speed and capacity relative to its predecessors, most recently 4G. Importantly, 5G describes a collection of standards and technologies used to build tomorrow's cutting-edge network infrastructure. In fact, many of the standards that will be officially considered 5G are still being decided on by working groups. The new standards are made possible by innovation across several technologies, including semiconductors, communications equipment like routers and antenna, and the sensors embedded in devices sitting on the edge of a network. These emerging technologies leverage a few trends in networking, such as the use of radio frequency above 6 GHz to reach desired speeds and benefits. Many service providers across countries, however, are attempting to bring 5G to lower radio frequencies, such as those considered sub-6 GHz or in bands used in existing cellular standards. Such variability reflects a diversity of approaches to 5G, as well as to some of the natural constraints of using higher frequency spectrum, like limited geographic range and susceptibility to interference. To work around these challenges, many carriers are deploying small cells or small cellular radios densely packed to achieve 5G coverage in a desired area. Many governments, including agencies like the US FCC, have just recently assigned responsibility for part of that spectrum, which carriers will need to guarantee widespread coverage and speed. FCC gives Google and Sony permission to dole out 3.5 gigahertz spectrum. 5G is a fifth-generation wireless technology for digital cellular networks that began wide deployment in 2019. Low-band uses a similar frequency range as the predecessor 4G. Sprint and China Mobile are using 2.5 gigahertz, while others are mostly between 3.3 and 4.2 gigahertz, a range which offers increased reach. Sub-6 5G would mean a 5G network using spectrum below 6 gigahertz. Current 4G deployments use predominantly spectrum below 3 GHz. There is a band around 3.5 GHz that's being considered for 5G, and spectrum in the range 5 GHz to 7 GHz will also likely be available for 5G as unlicensed spectrum, that is to say, Wi-Fi. Millimeter wave spectrum is in the range of 30 GHz to 300 GHz, based on availability of spectrum bands in different regions of the world. This varies because of military and satellite communications usage. For cellular, it will likely be 28 GHz, 39 GHz, and 60 GHz to 90 GHz. Part of the problem is the presence of absorption peaks at certain frequencies due to water vapor in the atmosphere. Millimeter 5G would be using this spectrum, and the advantage being the availability of large bandwidth, 100 MHz to 1 GHz, which translate into very high capacity. There is a band around 3.5 GHz that's being considered for 5G, and spectrum in the range 5 GHz to 7 GHz will also likely be available for 5G as unlicensed spectrum, that is to say, Wi-Fi-like availability. Millimeter wave spectrum is in the range 30 GHz to 300 GHz. In 2015, the FCC adopted rules for shared commercial use of the band 3.5 GHz. The commission established a citizens' broadband radio service and created a three-tier access and authorization framework to accommodate shared federal and non-federal use of the band. Spectrum in the 3.5 GHz band is expected to drive the first wave of fifth generation or 5G wireless broadband services, in large part because many countries have focused on harmonizing this spectrum for 5G use on an international basis. This should lead to faster data speeds and 5G network deployment. The FCC just gave Google, Sony, and two other companies the green light to open the 3.5 GHz band for commercial use, considered by many as a building block for 5G networks. The 3.5 GHz band could speed up 4G communication and enhance 5G networks, helping the latest iPhone and Android devices reach faster data speeds in the United States. The Federal Communications Commission named Google, Sony, CommScope, and Federated Wireless, Inc., Spectrum Access Systems Administrators. They're now authorized to make a slice of the 3.5 GHz band available for commercial purposes, meaning the private sector should finally have access to the mid-range spectrum for 5G networks. The FCC has made it a priority to free up mid-band spectrum for advanced wireless services like 5G. And today, they were pleased to announce that the latest step to achieve that priority, the approval of four systems that would enable 3.5 GHz band to be put to use for the benefit of American consumers and businesses. This has been a long time coming. The FCC voted to free up a piece of the 3.5 GHz spectrum in 2015, but multiple disputes delayed the effort. Previously, the band was used by the U.S. Navy Naval Radar System. The Navy didn't use the entire spectrum at all times, but the FCC had to sort out how to make room for both the Navy and commercial players. At this point, most people see opening the 3.5 GHz spectrum as overdue. 5G networks in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia already have access to the mid-range band. Hopefully, with these four companies free to move forward as SAS administrators, we'll see the 3.5 GHz spectrum put to use in the United States soon. Well, I have questions. How did these companies get selected to be administrators? We have Google, Sony, CommScope, and Federated Wireless. Inquiring minds wants to know, Google, a company that makes most of their money spying on users, gathering all their personal information to better target ads to them. I do kind of have a problem with that. And Sony is a Japanese company looking at the interest in the United States? That would be like Apple doing the same thing in Japan. Well, maybe it'll work out. I just think that the odds these days are slim And I hope that it works out for the United States. Presenting Marty Winston, Small Scale Solar Power for Outdoor Devices.
I have a friend who's a longtime TV weather guy. He even has a Davis weather station in his own yard. I have two weather stations in mine, an Accurite Atlas and a Weatherflow anyway. I was asking him how anybody ever does remote reads of snowfall depth. I thought there might be some gizmo to do that. He sent me a photo of a long measuring stick marked in feet and inches sticking straight up out of the snow. It looked a lot like one of those water level measuring sticks you see around ponds or streams. That measuring stick has a webcam pointing at it. I have no doubt but that the webcam is connected one way or another to a power line. It might be on the side of a nearby building, for example. And that got me to thinking, what would it take to power that kind of camera without a power line? Running an underground power line maybe 25 or 30 feet from the house? Well, that's going to mean an electrician, and by the time the trenching and all gets done, I'm guessing a few $100s. Is there an alternative? Well, one cheap option is to go to DC, use an AC adapter in the house, make it DC, and run your own low-voltage line out. Or one option is PoE, power over Ethernet. But you're still running a power line or a low-voltage line or an Ethernet cable to that camera. You're probably still using some kind of trenching and conduit, and you're also paying for the power adapter or a PoE injector or a PoE Ethernet switch. You may know the acronym TANSTAFL, TANSTAAFL. It's short for There Ain't No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. Can't we skip the buried wire altogether? Besides, what if that camera or whatever were much farther from power, like on a hilltop or in a more remote place? There is no electrical service to extend and certainly no Ethernet lines. What do you do to get power in those places? And how much power does that kind of camera need? That camera, what kind of camera is that kind of camera? So homework time, and I investigated outdoor video cameras. Keeping an eye on a snow depth marker, well, and it isn't moving, well, that could work well with a bullet-style camera, meaning a lens at one end and no covering dome. It could be close enough to the house for Wi-Fi to work. If there's a building of some kind there, of course, at that point, you can run a wire. If it's farther, you go to a cellular connection. Infrared or visible LEDs on the front should let it see as far as 50 to 60 feet in the dark, but about half that distance would be plenty. The camera only has to see the measuring stick. You could do a little bit of a weatherscape if you want, but it needs to see the measuring stick. So there's no need to tilt or pan. And once it has a good view of the stick, there's no need to zoom. So a simpler and less expensive fixed lens, fixed position camera should be fine. Of course, it does need to be outdoor qualified, weather resistant, and able to handle frosty or steamy temperatures. What will it take to power that? And let's get past AC. If you bought a power adapter for such a camera, how much power would it put out? I checked. I looked up some Canada cameras and looked into their accessories. The most typical answer seems to be that they expect a 12-volt power supply that's good for up to one full amp of current. And that makes sense, given that there will be times when it has to turn on those see-in-the-dark lights at the same time as it runs the camera and the video electronics and the Wi-Fi radio. So 12 volts, one amp, which also means 12 watts, outdoors, 24/7. Except it can't be. Cameras that can see in the dark tend to use infrared illuminators to do that. And in the dark, on average, year-round, that means 12 hours a day. That power adapter might tell us the peak, the maximum power demand, but that can't be the average. For that matter, it would be foolish to keep running a power adapter at its full rating, and even more foolish still to believe that it can actually deliver whatever its rating says it delivers. I got in touch with Simon Bailey at Sunforce Products. Sunforce Products. They make several kinds of off-grid power solutions. When I told him the application, he immediately said, "That's relatively low power, choose solar, not wind, especially if you ever want it to work at an unattended site." Based on that power adapter spec of one amp at 12 volts, he suggested, I'll take this slowly, a 12-volt solar array capable of producing a 2.5-amp charging current, the array mounted at an angle around 22.5 degrees, possibly using multiple panels connected through a combiner called a hub, and all feeding an AGM deep discharge storage battery. More about those in a minute. I asked, what if it's a region with a lot of snowfall? Won't that cover the panels and block the sun? He said, not for long. Whatever sunshine penetrates to the panels beneath the snow will make them warm up and the snow will slide off, which is the reason for the angled mounting. I asked about places that are always cloudy. He said that upsizing the solar panel could make a difference, but essentially, there are ways to look up latitude and longitude to determine how much of a fudge factor to incorporate. I asked about temperature extremes, and he said I should look up AGM batteries. AGM stands for absorbed glass mat. So I did. I looked them up. They're good at temperatures down to 40 degrees below. And if you remember your science classes, that's Fahrenheit or Celsius. They can't spill. They barely outgas at all, just a whisper. They've been used for a very long time. They've been around for a while. They're in use for things like wheelchairs, industrial forklifts, golf carts, backup power UPS products, small watercraft, and, as I may not need to mention, for off-grid energy solutions. You can skip listening for half a minute as I explain. Your grandpa's old car battery was lead acid with lead plates and a battery acid in water as an electrolyte. It was designed for cranking, not for discharging any deeper than about half of its capacity. About half a century ago, for applications where batteries had to deliver more power, more compactly, and not need the babysitting of water fills, the industry created a mostly sealed, all sealed except for a self-closing release valve in case the pressure inside gets too high, a mostly sealed battery that instead of flooding the plates in that water solution, uses a gelled electrolyte. Gel cells are still in use. About halfway to now, there was another advance using thin fiberglass mats, really thin, soaked almost to saturation in an electrolyte paste, went from liquid to gel to paste. The electrode plates are made a little thicker for deep discharge applications, the metal parts, but the mat is sandwiched right between them, and that makes for a very tight sandwich. So boom, the batteries could get more compact and deliver more power per charge. They also have much less internal resistance, so they deliver power more efficiently and barely heat up at all when charging. That's AGM. Don't worry about memorizing it. I don't think it's coming up on Jeopardy anytime soon. AGM batteries do cost more. I saw 12-volt units from about $100 to $800. The difference in price is the difference in capacity, and that can get very complicated indeed. You have to answer questions like, how cold will it get? How hot will it get? How many days do you need to be able to deliver power despite the charging source not contributing to the battery? That kind of thing. I also got in touch with a couple of the companies that make outdoor qualified Wi-Fi cameras. I asked how much power they used. The first one had no idea. The second one checked and said you could power theirs with a 12-volt half-amp AC adapter and that it used 1.5 amps for night vision. I asked, how could night vision draw 3 times as much power as the adapter could deliver? Well, they didn't know. I sure wish their training could include things like Ohm's Law and math, and one of these things is bigger than the other. There really is no end to this story, at least not yet. We're in the middle. I began with the question about whether we could reliably run things on modest amounts of power without running power lines to them or babysitting batteries. The answer is certainly yes, we can. But figuring out exactly how, and how economically, and how reliably, and all that, I don't have a grasp on that. At least not yet. Do you? Next time, to tell you the truth, I haven't really yet decided which topic I'll delve into next time. I want to take a hands-on look at some clever LED fixtures, and that could be coming up before long. I also want to take a look at the technology that's making self-driving cars possible and getting into the other applications they might accomplish outside the car, or maybe something else. I'm not sure how I'll choose. Maybe I'll wait and check out whether or not I can see my shadow. Tune in next week and find out.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on how to smartify your home. Thursday, February the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that's the ACGNJ, they have their general meeting on Friday, February the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, February the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, and they meet in the Silver Building. Check at the guard's desk for the room number, and NYU is located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and that's Valentine's Day. They meet at the Old Westbury campus at the New York Institute of Technology, Harry J. Scherr Hall, out in Westbury, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, February the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on current trends in personal technology. Thursday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival, Saturday, March the 21st. The College of New Jersey, Ewing, New Jersey. The original Personal Computer Festival is from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. The topic of presentation is How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. It's an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force with an eye towards a significant positive impact on our world. And there are other feature tech talks and workshops, which includes do-it-yourself home automation, tricks and tips for Windows 10, quantum computing, WordPress bootcamp, new Internet of Things using 5G, stock market trading using neural networks, hands-on Arduino workshop for beginners, all-day robotics pavilion, and many more. For more information, tcf-nj.org. That's the 45th Trenton Computer Festival, Saturday, March the 21st of this year. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank at pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, Benjamin Rockwell, and Mark Leoso, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.